Could you please call our third case?
The next case is A18-1013, in a matter of the petition of Lowell Hughes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We are ready when you are, Council for appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Julie Swedback, and I'm here on behalf of the relator, Lowell Keeney, who is seated in the courtroom in the back to my left. Ms. Keeney asserts five grounds to support reversal of TRA's sudden decision, in 2017 to continue her pension benefits after it repeatedly told her for 18 years that she would receive them for her lifetime. I'd like to focus on two of Ms. Keeney's arguments, two of her grounds, equitable estoppel and negligent misrepresentation. But first, I'd like to touch on this court's standard of review. In reviewing a decision from a state agency acting in a quasi-judicial capacity, this court must affirm that decision unless it is unsupported by substantial evidence or is arbitrary and capricious. Despite this being a lenient standard of review favoring the agency's decision, I think Ms. Keeney's case is one such case that merits reversal. The facts are largely undisputed, and TRA does a nice job of setting all those facts out in its brief and concluding that all of these undisputed facts support its decision. But substantial evidence is not a quantitative measure, but rather a qualitative assessment of the facts, or in other words, do the facts that really matter, analyzed in the context of case law and statute, support TRA's decision? I submit that this case turns largely, if not solely, on the significance of one fact. The fact that, beginning in 1999, TRA sent Ms. Keeney multiple letters containing erroneous information that led her to believe she would receive pension benefits for her lifetime. But when her ex-husband died in 2017, 18 years after this fact, TRA cut her off and told her for the first time that the pension benefits were guaranteed for her ex-husband's life only. But for these letters, these multiple misrepresentations, these multiple mistakes, Ms. Keeney would not be before this court. The significance of TRA's errors is a game changer in this appeal.
So you're arguing that in order to find, though, that there is equitable estoppel here, we would have to consider that to be wrongful conduct.
Correct. That would be the significance of those errors and how it relates to the decision that TRA made. Despite admitting its mistakes, regretting its mistakes, and apologizing to Ms. Keeney for misleading her for 18 years, TRA claims it has no liability or accountability to Ms. Keeney for upending her life. I respectfully disagree.
Mathematically, had the option been chosen that would have paid benefits for her life, she would have received less money during her ex-husband's life, correct?
Yes, and that's set out in our brief, and the significance of that election, and I was just using the raw data that TRA provided, where I took the numbers that were estimated in 1994 when Mr. Keeney was 51 years old.
At the time of the divorce?
At the time of the divorce,
right.
the numbers that are stated in the judgment and decree, the 1462, were numbers that were estimated for the Life A1 no refund plan, but back 2 years earlier. Then when he retired in 1999, he asked again for new numbers, and the number had changed to 4,000-something for that same plan. If he had chosen the 100% survivorship option, he would have received she would have received her half of that difference would have been $97 a month. So it wasn't a significant number. If he had chosen the 100% survivorship option, she would have continued to get the benefit that she's now getting and would have received, it's about $1,000 a year less over 18 years. So it's not a significant number.
Ms. Whitbeck, I want to go back to the wrongful conduct discussion, if we could.
Sure.
I mean, clearly this is a very sympathetic case and a most unfortunate result for Ms. Keene. But I wrote the Sarpel decision for this court. I felt, and the panel and the court felt, that that was wrongful conduct on the part of the governing authority. The Supreme Court told us summarily it was not.
Justice Anderson disagreed.
Yes, yeah. And that, and the whole court, that, you know, a mistake, inadvertence, does not constitute wrongful conduct. And so I'm struggling with how this is different from that.
So Sarpel,
this does seem to be a mistake. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any intentional conduct here.
That's correct. It's a mistake. And I've read both the Sarpel, your decision, as well as the Supreme Court's decision. And I think the significance of the Sarpel decision is that the Supreme Court said what wrongful conduct is not. And it is not a simple mistake, one mistake, mere inadvertence. Ms. Keeney's position is that, well, if it's not a simple mistake, then what about two mistakes or three mistakes or a consistent misrepresentation over a lengthy period of time that she relied on and now is suffering, the only one who's suffering the consequences of that? And there's a case that's cited. I reviewed countless cases, countless wrongful conduct cases to find a similar factual pattern here, and the only one that I came up with was Eureka Township, which is cited in our brief. It's an unpublished, a 2017 or 2015 unpublished case by this court that says that over a number of years, the township board led or represented to some landowners that they had an exotic animal farm and it was a permissive use. And ultimately, it was they reversed their decision and said that, no, you don't get to use your land for this purpose, and the landowner sued on the grounds of equitable estoppel, and the district court found that repeated misrepresentations over a number of years that the landowners had met the wrongful conduct standard under Sarpel. So Ms. Keeney's argument is that while one mistake might not be, equitable estoppel or wrongful conduct,
Correct.
Well, there's
that third letter was sent to her ex-husband, not to her.
Nope. She received three letters, and the first two letters were identical letters. And this is also what's so, I guess, wrong about this case is that in 1999, they sent a letter to both of them. Mr. Keeney's letter identified that he had selected the Life A1 plan, no refund, I believe it said. And then that he would be getting this amount for X number of years until he turned 65, and then it would adjust down so the temporary portion would be gone and he'd get the life. They sent the exact same letter.
Accelerated payments till 65, basically.
He had accelerated payments until 65, and then it adjusted down, and he was getting about half of what he had been getting. They sent the exact letter to Ms. Keeney. They did not identify the plan that he selected. All they said was, your ex-husband's retired. Here's what you're going to get. It'll adjust in 2006. They didn't say why. It'll adjust in 2006, and then you will get this benefit for your lifetime. So it was an error, administrative error, by the customer service agents at TRA that said, you know, they didn't tailor the letter specific to the circumstances. The other thing about the wrongful conduct cases in Sarpel and the simple mistake is, pretty much every case that I reviewed and the cases that Sarpel relied on, the Kmart case, the Ridgewood case, and the Masaba case, those involved one mistake. And most of the time, these cases come before this court based on one mistake. Ms. Keeney didn't know there was a mistake until 18 years after the mistake had perpetuated into, you know, her being 18 years older and in her retirement years, and she's lost half of her income. That's not her fault. That is wrongful conduct on the part of TRA. And I think the other argument that makes this very interesting is under equitable estoppel, the first conduct, kind of an overarching threshold issue, I don't think it's really a threshold issue, but it's one that the TRA relies on, is whether it had authority to act. And they're hiding behind the statute that says, no, we don't have authority to act, we don't have authority to reinstate her benefits, we don't have authority to pay her more than the plan provided for, the plan that was elected by her ex-husband. This is not an authority to act case. Masaba, Sarpel, Kmart, they all talk about whether or not an agent or a government actor is authorized to act. And that may be drawing a fine line, but I think it's an important distinction to draw a line between authority to act, given by the statute or precluded by the plan documents, and whether or not the employees who sent out the letter were authorized to act. Consider the difference between a letter of authorization and a power of attorney. Both of them are based on authority. Power of attorney, the attorney, in fact, has authority to make determinations on behalf of the principal. A letter of authorization, however, just allows an agent of the principal to permit that agent to have an undertaking, to undertake a duty or a responsibility. And under agency law, if an agent acts within its authority, the principal is bound by the agent's actions and its mistakes. And I think that's what we have here. So Ms. Keeney is not asking the TRA to do something it has no authority to do, that it has no authority to do now. Because what Ms. Let's step back. So the question becomes is, did the TRA authorize its employees to send out letters to pension members about their benefits? Yes, they were authorized to send those letters out. The fact that the letters that were sent out, I mean, that was their job. The fact that the letters they sent out contained inaccurate information isn't Ms. Keeney's problem. It's a work audit issue. It's a training issue. It's an issue that shouldn't fall to the detriment of Ms. Keeney. And under these facts, TRA's persistent failure to audit its work it authorized its employees to do should not allow it to use the statute as a shield and a sword. And I think the other thing that's really relevant to this court's review is the fact that she got the letter in 1999. She got an identical letter in 2001. And then the third letter, the first two letters said she would get these benefits for her lifetime. And then the 2006 letter that they both got said, now Richard is 65, this is what his explained, the temporary portion of your annuity is over, and you will now the life portion will continue. She had been told for 7 years that she was gonna get these benefits for her life. It was reasonable for her to assume that the 2006 letter was talking about her life, not her ex-husband's life.
And I can look for that letter again, but my recollection is that it referred to benefits for Richard's life, but did not make
it
mention of hers.
It said the life portion.
But in reference to him.
I don't recall if it specified to that detail. I can look it up in it's in the addendum. But the fact of the matter is that this was 2006, and she had been told since 1999 that she would get these benefits for her lifetime. The fact that the life...
I know that was clear from the first two letters.
Correct. Yeah. And so she was led to believe that, and she had a reasonable right to believe it. The other issue that TRA makes a very big deal out of is that Ms. Keeney could have accessed this information on her own. This also goes into the equitable estoppel. She could have discovered, or she should have discovered, that the information they were sending her was wrong. Why would she? She got a letter. It didn't identify any plan. They were consistent in making these payments for 18 years. And then all of a sudden, they say, oh, sorry, this was only guaranteed for your ex-husband's life. There was nothing about TRA's representations to her, the way they operated, that would have triggered her obligation or piqued her interest to say, I wonder if I'm really supposed to be getting this because... this is a really good deal. I better call and check and find out and make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing.
There was nothing in the dissolution that indicated what type of annuity or what type of choice he had to make.
Correct. All there was an amount listed, the 1462, which was split between the two of them, so presumably they were each getting a little over $700. The 1462 amount referred to, this was in 1996, referred to a letter that only Mr. Keeney had received in 1994 that listed out his options. He had, the parties were separated at the time. They hadn't lived together for 2 years. So Richard was operating in kind of his own little sphere. She had no idea what was going on. They get divorced. She knows he's got a TRA pension. The decree divides it in half, and he didn't retire until 3 years later. And TRA is going to try and tell you that that 1462 amount should have been information to her that he was selecting the life-only plan. She didn't have access to that letter. There's, that letter is not attached to the divorce decree as an exhibit, and there's not even any information anywhere that she had any idea that that's the plan that he selected.
Should that have been explored at the time of the dissolution as to what options were available?
Maybe it was. It's not identified in any, and they did a mediation. The mediator is, I think he's passed. She was not represented by an attorney. Mr. Keeney's attorney has passed. The district court judge has retired. The people from TRA who were the actors in the very beginning are gone. So there really isn't any way to go back and figure out whether that was discussed. But the fact of the matter is, what we've got, the information that we do have, shows that she didn't have any idea. And she was told, and even if she had an idea, well, that's not even if she had it, even if there was some inkling of it, the fact that they sent the letters over 18 years leading her to believe that she was going to get this amount for her lifetime, that's where the harm comes in. That's where the wrongful conduct comes in, and that's where the estoppel lies.
Judge Rodenberg has one more question.
The 1462 number sounds an awful lot. It's very close to the 1511 number from 2006.
Correct.
Do we know from the record if the 1462 number was considering an acceleration to age 65 or wasn't?
It was not.
It was not. Do we know that it was?
We know that it was not because if you look at the 1994 letter, I don't believe the 1994 letter outlined the accelerated amount. But if you look at the 1999 letter, it does lay out the if he retires at normal retirement age with the no refund, you'll get this. And if you do an accelerated benefit, then you'll get this. And then it will adjust to that. I think it's somewhat coincidental, Judge Rodenberg, that the 1511 that she was receiving when Mr. Keeney died was near what...
It seems like that's fairly close. I mean, with right, cost but, of living adjustments and whatever.
Right, but remember, too, she was only supposed to get half of the 1462.
Right.
So in 1994, that was the amount. In 2006, she was getting half of the life portion. And so 12 years, the amount that she was getting also increased exponentially from 1999 to 2001. It went up quite a bit.
Because of COLAs and stuff.
Because of COLAs or investments or something, the fact.
I've probably got far enough there.
Thank you, Ms. Webbad. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Catherine Woodruff on behalf of the Teachers Retirement Association. These cases all present difficult issues because they're human costs when mistakes are made. In this case, Relator received what she was entitled to under her divorce decree, regardless of whether the letters in 1999 and 2001 were correct or not. Pursuant to the decree, There was no restriction on the benefit that her former husband could select. Just for context, well, first, the point is, from his contributions to TRA, she received all she was entitled to. The question we have now is whether she is entitled to other people's contributions to pay these benefits for the rest of her life. To put it in context, TRA received 170 divorce decrees or so last year. less than about a third put restrictions on what benefits could be split or not. 55.
Do we know this from the record?
That is not from the record. I was just trying to give you some context.
Right, but I mean, we don't know that from.
So it my main point is it is 23 of those restricted the type of choice that could be made. It is not uncommon to have a dissolution decree that does not restrict a choice. And in fact, you'll see in the decree here.
This one does not.
This one does not. You'll see here that's, frankly, the preference in the law for dividing things in divorce is not to split benefits. It causes difficulties, as we're finding here. You'll see in this decree that some of the IRAs, one went one direction, one went the other. Some of the real estate, one went one direction, one went the other. In this case, the TRA benefits actually were split 50-50. But there was no restriction on the benefit that the member could choose at the time he retired. There are two places. In divorce proceedings, in addition, there are protections that are given to the parties. They have the opportunity for counsel. These decrees are mediated. This is one of those. It said it was the product of full disclosure. I think TRA is entitled to rely on that. In two places, there's reference to the amount of the benefit that was being proposed, that 1462. It's not just on page 14. It's also, rather, in the addendum, it's on pages 18 and 21, both reference that amount. It corresponds with the single life benefit that was chosen at the time. It's a very specific number. It's reasonable to assume someone would have asked why or how that number was picked. TRA did give a sheet of information, it's true, to the member. He requested it in connection with the divorce. And so whether or not that paper was provided to relator in this case, she certainly had the benefit of that information. And he happened to pick the same plan 3 years later when he retired. He added the acceleration portion later. The question was, in the original letter, was the acceleration estimate included? That was not. It was included in the second. And you'll see that in the record there. But he picked the second highest amount of payments that could have come. There was only one stream of payments that would have been higher. And that is if he had retired at 62, with the acceleration to 62 instead of to 65, rather. So at that time, we know that relator called to make sure the decree was on file. She executed a withholding form. We see that in the record. Consistent with that decree and the options selected by the member, TRA made payments for 18 years. They are in the vicinity of $435,000. That is in the record. TRA didn't have the duty to notify her of his choice. And you'll note that divorce proceedings are treated differently than standard retirement benefit elections that have to do with spouses. Spouses have extra protections because at the time they aren't going through a proceeding that a court is overseeing or that you have the opportunity to have counsel for. So there are special notifications that go to spouses. They have to sign off, for example. If a 50% survivor benefit is not selected, the spouse actually has to sign a notarized waiver. That is not true for divorce. That's the legislature's choice. They presume, I think reasonably, that parties to a divorce proceeding have the protections of counsel and a court and can negotiate the terms that they please. That is the process that happened here. It is true, and I'm not trying to minimize, that two letters went out that had a mistake. It is true, 1999 and 2001. You should know that precautions have been taken to ensure that does not happen again. The 2006 letter, there was a little bit of questions about that. Those two letters were different. There were letters that went out to both, on page 34 and 35 of the addendum. There were two letters that went out. One went out to the member, one went out to the relator. The member's letter continues the language that talks about payments for your lifetime. It's the fourth paragraph. That paragraph is not in the letter that went to the relator here. There is a reference, as was already identified, to the life portion of the annuity. The language saying that payments will be for your lifetime did not appear in her letter, only in his. So that mistake was corrected at least as of 2006, if not earlier. I guess the main point that I was making earlier, though, is even if those letters were accurate, the stream of payments that went to the relator were what she was entitled to under the decree and his election. And so again, the issue is now, is there any legal precedent for turning to other people's contributions to continue these payments for her lifetime? Respectfully, TRA asserts there is not. In this case, estoppel is the argument that's been raised, two types. There was a discussion about what authority TRA has and does not have in this situation. TRA did never have the authority, never had the authority to offer her a benefit that her husband didn't choose. And so, yes, it was, the letters contained a mistake. The same is true in Sell, if you look at the Sell case that is cited in the TRA's brief. Over a 19-year period, every year on a website, this person's benefits didn't contain an accurate amount for 19 years. In that case, this court concluded that that was a mistake that couldn't bind the agency to make a stream of payments that was never authorized to begin with. And that was what we're facing here. This stream of payments that's being requested, I think that's an important distinction here. What's being requested is a stream of payments that reflects an option that wasn't chosen. TRA does not have the option to do that within the context of its tax-qualified plan.
Right. Well, mathematically, you would never have the option to pay a benefit based on one life measure over the course of two life measures.
All that is taken. It is actually more complicated than it might seem from the briefs. It's a complicated calculation.
Well, I'm sure. I'm not even trying to do it.
All of the six benefits that are offered are designed to be actuarially equivalent. In other words, the benefit that's given is designed to equal out over the course of the lifetimes. And again, we estimate lifetimes, right? But
certain hypotheticals.
Absolutely.
About
if you have
life expectancy and interest rates and what have you.
And life expectancy of your named survivor. So in this case, had there been a different option chosen, the benefits would have been lower throughout, even including acceleration. There is a lost opportunity for investment income to the fund to pay out higher. There are losses that I guess are difficult to calculate without more information.
Right. I don't think the appellant is quarreling with all of that. What the appellant is saying is if you wouldn't have sent her that letter, then she would have had some information that would have caused her to act in a different manner.
Yes, and I think that the answer to that is there was never any restriction on the access to the information about the account. I know that may sound a little hollow after the fact. There was always access. If you are a party to a divorce decree that is being enforced by TRA, you always have access to the information about your account. And I agree, the two letters were a mistake. And we would argue that those are not wrongful conduct. The Eureka Township case, frankly, even I think supports TRA in this respect. But the Supreme Court has defined wrongful conduct to be something unlawful, like an evil deed. That's a quote, actually, from the In Re Ventura case that the Supreme Court decided in 1999. And so the unlawfulness of the conduct and the fact that it is more than just inadvertence, this was a mistake. It had consequences. I'm not trying to minimize that, but is estoppel available in a situation like this? Respectfully, not.
I have a question about if she had passed away first, would her estate have continued to receive the payments?
There would have been. It would have continued. Her estate would have. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe her estate would have received the payments until he died.
Oh, he died.
Because it was split. I mean, he doesn't get those back, to my knowledge. Again, we have two members of TRA in the audience. I should have introduced them. Rachel Barth and Joel Hohenstein are both here from TRA. If your honors have no further questions, I don't need the rest of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Woodruff.
Rebuttal? Just briefly, a couple of points. Ms. Woodruff referred to the fact that Ms. Keeney called TRA in 1999, and there are actually two references to that in the record, one at page 6, footnote 3, and one at page 12, lines 3 to 4 and 5 to 7. This is the first time TRA has ever disclosed that fact. There is no citation to the record. There is nothing in the record and no citation to the record in their brief. So Ms. Keeney would ask the court to reject or to disregard any inferences that TRA may be asking this court to draw from those acts. As far as her having access to the information, I touched briefly on that in my opening argument, and it's the, the Mueller case distinguishes between access to facts and access to a law or ordinance. This was 1999. There's a lot that's happened technology-wise in there, and the only place in 1999 that I'm aware of that Ms. Keeney could have received information would have been from the TRA itself. And the information that she did was given was wrong. Ms. Woodruff again recites all of the facts that they've set forth in their brief that support or substantial support for its decision. Again, as I mentioned at the outset of my argument, the only relevant fact here is the mistaken letters that TRA sent to Ms. Keeney over 18 years, how does that change the analysis? And I would submit that it doesn't matter if there were restrictions or not in the divorce decree. It doesn't matter that she received what she was supposed to get based on the divorce decree. It doesn't matter whether she's entitled or she's asking for other members' benefits. I don't know that there has to be some other way for the TRA to come up with, if this court finds in Ms. Keeney's favor, to pay her, Ms. Keeney, what she was entitled to or what she was represented that she was going to receive, whether it's through special legislation or not, but that's a problem for the TRA. All of those things are irrelevant when you look at the fact that whether it's equitable estoppel or negligent misrepresentation, TRA's employees did something they were authorized to do. They sent out letters that contained inaccurate information, and it's great that TRA has now taken precautions to not allow that to happen anymore, but it's also a reflection that there was a problem with their training. And that, again, is not Ms. Keeney's problem. Ms. Woodruff refers to the Sell case as a factual pattern that's analogous to the repeated mistakes. The Sell case, first of all, is an unpublished case from 2011. And in that case, Sell was a doctor, and he had a dentist, and he had withdrew some of his, all of his $69,000 worth of service credits from his MSRS account. But for some reason, MSRS did not, their system did not reflect that. Again, this is 2011. He had access to that. This is a case, it's not analogous, because this is a case where the actor himself, he withdrew. He made an affirmative act withdrawing that information and then noticed that the system didn't update it. Ms. Keeney has no part in all of this. She was there. She received information. She relied on that information, and now they cut her off. So Sell is not analogous, and it's an unpublished decision, and I don't even think persuasive in this manner. Other than that, if the court has no more questions, I have nothing else. And I would ask the court to reverse the TRA's decision and reinstate Ms. Keeney's benefits that she was promised to, retroactive to September of 2017. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Swedback, and thank you, Ms. Woodruff. Case has been submitted.